Welcome to episode 6 of The Infectious Myth. Thank you, the audience, for listening to this show in which I try to bring you people who are challenging the scientific and medical establishment. Today, I have with me Eric Merola, director of 3 documentary films related to cancer. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's very good to be talking to you, and thank you for getting up so early to join us.
No problem.
I understand that you're doing some traveling related to these three films. The three films, and correct me if I make any mistakes as I go through this, the three films are Brzezinski, the movie from 2010, Cancer is Serious Business, also about Brzezinski from 2013, and Second Opinion, 2014, which is about the Laetrile controversy.
Correct. There's 2 Brzezinskis. One is essentially a biographical sort of background on Brzezinski, and part 2 was sort of a modern story following some of the Brzezinski patients. But yes, that's correct. And then Second Opinion is my brand new one.
Yes. Yeah, so let's talk about Brzezinski first, because he is a very interesting character. He is... I'm not sure if we should describe him as providing an alternative therapy, but he provides, within the United States, a relatively non-toxic cancer, or maybe completely non-toxic cancer therapy. And he's been in a struggle with the FDA that's lasted decades, but now the FDA has, to some extent, accepted his therapy. Is that sort of the outline?
Pretty much. They're not really accepting his therapy with a smile on their face, if you will. essentially, you know, what they're doing here to Brzezinski is, frankly, pretty common. When somebody has a new scientific innovation that threatens the status quo this severely, they tried everything they could back in the 1990s. The FDA tried everything they could to, destroy Brzezinski. And they, created a bunch of federal charges. There was 2 juried federal trials in the 90s to try to throw him in prison for the rest of his life for charges unrelated to whether or not the therapy worked. It was about mail fraud and all sorts of things that they could do to try to throw him in jail. But Brzezinski won, so they were sort of forced to accept it because, you know,
Is it true that the FDA has a SWAT team? By that I mean heavily armed police, and that they raided his offices and took away all his records at one point?
Oh, absolutely. They did it numerous times. There was numerous raids over the course throughout the 80s and the 90s. Yep.
And those records, last I heard, were never returned.
A lot of the records he never even got back. It took him over a decade to get some of the records back. Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, well, let's talk a little bit about his therapy. My understanding from reading Ralph Moss's book, The Cancer Industry, many years ago, that his therapy is called anti-neoplastons, which isn't terribly helpful because that basically just means anti-cancer.
Correct.
But they're natural compounds that were originally extracted from human urine. Is that...
Yeah, it was actually initially extracted from the blood. Then he went on to extract the peptides from human urine. But that was only over the course of maybe 3 to 4 years. By the early 1980s, he was able to synthesize them in a lab. So he made them from scratch. Because the initial invention was, the short of it is, he found a strain of peptides in human blood and also in human urine that had never been discovered before. And the short of it is that people that had cancer had a really low count of these peptides. I mean, he was studying these peptide levels in every type of person you can imagine. And finally he got to people with cancer, realized they had low levels of these. So he hypothesized, if I could just extract them from healthy donors, give them to people with cancer, that's sort of where it began.
I mean, it doesn't always follow that if you find a surrogate marker, some kind of chemical that's different in people who are sick versus people who are healthy, that if you add that chemical to their body or take it away, if there's an excess, that necessarily improves health. But in his case, he did find that these peptides did have an impact on cancer.
Sure. And it wasn't every single person, really, either. It's like anything in science where it's not a magic bullet. It's not across the board. It seems to have a response rate of around, you know, half or less kind of thing with patients. So, yes, correct.
But some of the patients that he's had success rate with are brain cancer patients, where he has a relatively high success rate versus mainstream chemotherapy radiation, which has extremely low success rate with brain cancers. That also
absolutely. Changed. Yeah, there is almost. In fact, there's only two drugs on the market for brain cancer: Tamiflu and Avastin. Neither one of them have cured a single patient in any clinical trial. The response rate is barely anything, but it's just sort of the climate that we're in with a sort of brain cancer with any kind of mainstream medicine. The reason he has so many brain cancer patients is sort of just how the chips fell, where when you get diagnosed with brain cancer, especially the types of brain cancer that end up going to Brzezinski, you're just pretty much told that there's nothing that can be done. You can have it removed with surgery, but it's almost impossible to get all the cancer cells out with surgery. And so that's sort of what happened. Most of the people that have, say, lung or melanoma or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, anything like that, they've already been sort of destroyed and exhausted all therapies before they go to Brzezinski. But brain cancer patients, he usually gets them fresh, if you will. And that's one of the reasons why he has so many of them.
And I presume the reason for that is that chemotherapy and radiation are so damaging to the body's ability to regenerate that it's difficult to work with alternative therapies when people have been through the full rigmarole of the mainstream therapies.
Correct. I mean, chemotherapy and radiation really destroy the immune system. I mean, so many people die of things like pneumonia and things related to having their immune system destroyed versus actually dying of the cancer itself. So, yeah, it's very, very difficult when you have a patient that's been that has that much baggage, coming with them. So,
right. And do you have information on his success rate with brain cancer patients? Like, what kind of success in terms of stopping or reversing the cancer?
Well, it's very irresponsible, of course, just to give a blanket statistic. Every type of cancer has a little bit different statistic. But, because he's in FDA clinical trials, so the statistics based on those trials is really the best thing. So, for instance, there's a really rare form of cancer that's extremely deadly called a DIPG. It usually happens in kids. It stands for diffuse intrinsic brainstem glioma, and this is a really nasty tumor that forms in the brainstem. And basically, up until before antineoplastons were invented, Brzezinski's therapy, there's never been any patient in a clinical trial ever cured. There are like maybe one or two spontaneous remissions, like in the history of the world, that where we just magically got better. But nobody's made it through it in any kind of controlled setting. Brzezinski has close to a 30%. That's 5-year survival or cure rate with this tumor type in FDA clinical trials.
Wow.
So it's like 0 versus 30. And,
that's pretty huge. I mean, and given that his therapy is not toxic, that would seem like a no-brainer. Pardon, that's a terrible pun, but it wasn't intentional. But the FDA doesn't see it as a no-brainer, do they?
No. I mean, for instance, I'll talk about this a little bit more. Not only is a DIPG never been cured before, but for a new substance, like antineoplastons that's been presented to the market or proposed to be put on the market, antineoplastons is the first new substance to ever been granted permission to start a randomized phase 3 trial to get them approved for market. Nothing has ever shown enough safety and efficacy ever other than antineoplastons. And yes, it should have been on the market over a decade ago, frankly. When Tamiflu and Avastin, the two drugs I mentioned earlier that were the only drugs that are the only drugs approved for brain cancer, they never even had to go through a randomized study. They were approved at what's called accelerated approval. So they had very limited, small, maybe 50 to 100 patients total were treated in clinical trials, and they just put it right on the market because there's a slight, benefit, in clinical trials for brain cancer.
Probably that benefit is not like a benefit in terms of cure, but it's probably a benefit in terms of surrogate markers that are related to disease progression or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, they have these. Yeah, exactly. It's almost nothing. It's almost, and again, they didn't even test it in a randomized study where you can test it against another group, to see if it was much better. But here's the problem. This is where it all comes down to with Brzezinski and what the market can allow, frankly, is that if they put antineoplastons on the market for this condition, which would make logical sense because there's no other therapy ever in history to cure this condition, much less help it. So if they put it on the market under the accelerated approval, which is, it's perfectly valid to be done that way, if it's the other ones work. The problem is that anybody with cancer, because that means if it's on the market for just this one condition, it's in everybody's oncologist's office, or theoretically, every oncologist has access to it. So if you, say, have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and you know based on history that non-Hodgkin's lymphoma was cured, but even though it's not approved for that, you can get it off-label, like anything else. That wouldn't be something that has to be advertised, but it's just a reality. So the point is that antineoplastons would be on the market, just even though it's just for that one condition, anybody can get it, and they could get it if that was the situation, and that's a big problem, and that's what they're most afraid of, because the chemotherapy and radiation, I mean, it's been around for decades with not a whole lot of happy progress, and everyone that's seen anyone go through it, knows how horrible it is, and if you have the choice between antineoplastons or that, even if your insurance won't cover it, what's sort of a no-brainer? What are you going to choose?
Yes. Well, it's hard for a lot of people probably to understand why this would be a problem. But the problem is, of course, that antineoplastons would threaten the sales of mainstream cancer therapies.
Yep.
Two questions about antineoplastons. First of all, are they patented by Brzezinski or other people?
Yes, they're patented by Brzezinski. This is also another sort of convoluted area. Because antineoplastons are still in the sort of clinical trial phase of the process, even technically the patent should have been expired a while ago, but they're not because they're protected because he's still in the testing process technically on paper. So if he ever got it on the market, he'll have about 7 years of exclusivity before it would become a generic drug and anyone could make it. So,
okay. Well, that would seem to be reasonable considering the amount of money he must have spent fighting the FDA apart from developing these products. I remember reading that Ralph Moss once said, I think when he was testifying in front of Congress, that there has been no drug approved by the FDA that is not both highly toxic and patented. In this case, it's patented but not highly toxic, so it would be a novel thing for the FDA.
Right, correct.
And that was drugs for cancer. Obviously, they've approved non-toxic drugs for other conditions, but cancer, it seems like a drug almost has to have the capability to kill you or it wouldn't be approved by the FDA, and I don't quite understand that.
I agree. It's very interesting how cancer therapy, out of the gate, back in the early 1900s and on, that every single thing they proposed and decided to use was something that was lethally toxic, I'm not really, it's just sort of how the chips fell, sadly. But yeah.
The first chemotherapy, I understand, was derived from mustard gas, which was the World War I chemical warfare agent.
Correct.
And I think the war on cancer is completely applicable because that was the model that was used against cancer. Cancer was an enemy, and we were going to go into the trenches, and we were going to slay it, and what the land looked like after the war, well, it wouldn't be very pretty, but if we won the war, then maybe the trees would grow back, and things would start to look okay again. Doesn't always work out too well.
Right. Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, in chemotherapy, when it was first invented, they used mustard gas, for that. To experiment initially, it's interesting because it only really worked for things like leukemia and like lymphoma back then, and they just blanket way to say, oh, wow, it works in leukemia. Let's give it to any and everyone that's ever had, you know, cancer. Yeah, so any type of cancer.
But then they also went on a program of eliminating. I mean, there have been many alternative therapies in the U.S., and part of the war, perhaps the most serious part of the war, has been to methodically eliminate anybody who's proposed an alternative. Like, and Ralph, I mean, one of the things I'm sure you're very aware of, Ralph Moss's book, The Cancer Industry, which is a, sort of a classic, that goes through a lot of alternative therapies and how they were eliminated. There were things like Coley's toxin, which were quite widely accepted in the early 1900s, that were gradually eliminated because they were quite cheap, quite effective, and they threatened the highly profitable business of you know, cancer, chemotherapy, and radiation and surgery.
Correct. It's interesting. It was Ralph's book, The Cancer Industry, that got me into all of this. I think similar to you, actually. It just so you know, I mean, I read that book back in 2007, and I enthralled by the Brzezinski story first, and did two films on that, of course, and then now I've done his story that happened to him at Sloan Kettering. But going to Coley's toxins, I have a 10 to 15 minute short film on that, actually, on the DVD extras, because that was a big part of what was going on at Sloan Kettering. I don't want to totally shift gears yet if you don't want to yet, but yeah, Coley's toxins, I mean, it cured, documentedly, there's documents, it cured 1,000 people before radiation and chemotherapy had ever been invented. And so it wasn't until radiation came on the scene in the 30s that they sort of quietly and politely pushed Coley's toxins to the side. But it was on its way to be the new cancer therapy, but it's, you know, even today, it's only cost about $2 to make a 5-gallon bucket of Coley's toxins. I mean, there's no patent really on it, and there's no money in it.
Speaking of money, what is the approximate cost of therapy with any neoplastons? How long do you have to keep taking them? And are there any side effects from taking them?
Sure. Every patient is different with antineoplastons. I'll start with side effects. Yes, you're putting into your body a pretty large amount of fluids. In Brzezinski Part 2, I get into the details of the actual therapy itself and how it's administered, where you can see patients changing the bags on their own at home. You have these two big IV bags you're carrying around with you, hooked through an electric pump that goes into your Hickman line in your chest. That's a surgically implanted Hickman line. Anyway, so because you're putting a large amount of new liquid in your system, there's, you know, chills and fever are common in the first little bit until your body adjusts to it. There's a lot of sodium in the therapy because that's how it's sort of delivered. So you have to kind of keep a track of your electrolyte levels and your blood levels. But very minor when you compare them to the sort of devastating effects of chemo and radiation. They're more like annoying side effects than life-threatening side effects. You know what I mean? So, then to answer your question about how long, I mean, some patients go, one patient I was following from Brzezinski Part 2 was on it for 9 months before the tumor went completely away. And then as a safety precaution, she stayed on it for another 9 months. So that's 18 months. So it's, it's a lot. Yeah.
And in other cases, it's longer or shorter than that?
Yeah, it has been. And there are some people that have been on it for like 4 to 5 years, like some of these DIPG patients. It's very tough tumor. Like, there's a kid in San Francisco I've been trying to follow, and his name is Noah Stout. And it's been almost 4 years now he's been on antineoplastons. And it hasn't made the tumor go away, but the kid has lived twice as long as he's supposed to have. Basically, 90% of the kids with that diagnosis are dead by the second year, and it's going on 4 years now. So,
wow. I mean, I think one of the powerful things about a film treatment for this story is that you actually see real people, because too much of the discussions in cancer therapy are kind of virtual discussions about response rates and things like that, and you lose track of the fact that you're dealing with individual people, and in every case, their cancer is individual, their particular situation. So it is interesting to actually see the individuals.
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of sad because the testing process is the idea of throwing a bunch of individuals that are supposed to be the same into one group as if they're all the same, you know, and testing therapy against it. When it's like nowadays, because antineoplasmins are technically a gene-targeted therapy. Everything really is a gene-targeted therapy. Anything and everything can affect your genes and how your genes react.
Right.
In the sense that, like, nowadays you can have a diagnosis and have a part of your tumor biopsy sent to a lab and your blood sent to a lab to sort of have it run your whole genetic genome, see what, how your body's reacting to this cancer and the genes in relationship to it. So nowadays you can technically almost test to see if any drug will work on a patient, knowing, what we know about certain drugs and how they react to genes. Anyway, but they don't, they just mix them all together and treat them all the same, which is another part of the system that needs to be updated, if you will.
Right. And I mean, I think the whole idea that there are particular types of cancer, I question that. I think that that cancer is basically classified by symptoms and by cell type and location of the cancer. It doesn't necessarily mean that two cancers with similar cell types have the same cause and will have the same, best treatment.
Right. Correct.
Yes. So regarding the cost of this, I mean, if you have to do therapy for, a couple of years, maybe 4, 5, 6 years, how much does this cost? Because that's a big issue in the United States without, state, without socialized medicine.
Sure. It's constantly, the environment is constantly changing. So now the FDA is saying, okay, if you have a brain tumor, you can get this medicine, but you have to, Brzezinski can't give it to you anymore. That's what they're saying now. This has just changed in the last few weeks. You have to find a local oncologist, that agrees to give this medicine to you. So Brzezinski has to provide it for free, which is, it's always been that way. Even when you're in a clinical trial, you don't pay for the medication itself.
Right.
There are often services that are related to it that you have to pay for. So, for instance, back when Brzezinski was giving it, you're looking at between $7,000 to $10,000 a month to be on this therapy, which is, your insurance will not cover it. So it sounds like a lot of money, but it's still far less than most drugs on the market. Avastin alone is over $100,000 a year, and that's just one drug without even having to add a bunch of stuff to it. Anyway, so now you would get it for free, but all the services related to it would be covered by your insurance because your oncologist is taking care of you, just like he would if he was giving you standard chemo instead he's giving you antineoplasmin. So, but on average, I would guess and say $100,000 a year, because that's about basically what it would cost before the FDA made these changes. So,
right. So would it be? That $7,000 to $10,000 a month, it is a lot of money, but that includes all the administration of the therapy and all the monitoring that's necessary, all that kind of stuff, not just the antineoplastons themselves.
Yeah, correct. Because you have to have Hickman line surgically implanted into your chest. You're going to have to either rent or purchase this fairly sophisticated piece of equipment with this electric pump. You have to have your blood levels constantly checked, all kinds of things like that. You also have MRIs, there's everything that goes along with it, anything with something as serious as a brain tumor. So, correct.
Okay. It's interesting. So the current status is we're in, Brzezinski's in clinical trials with the FDA, and that when these clinical trials complete, assuming that they produce a positive result, then these compounds will go on the market?
Well, in the way that our supposed free market system is supposed to work, but they're doing everything they can to stop this. I mean, it would be too detrimental if they took her on the market financially. For people, it would be amazing, but imagine if they allow this on the market. I mean, who's going to touch chemotherapy and radiation ever again? Unless, of course, it's something very specific. So it's like their worst fear, because it really could destroy it. I mean, not only that. I mean, if you imagine, so let's just say it's on the market, right? Let's just pretend that Pfizer owned the rights to it, or so you think about it. They go, okay, well, we're just going to destroy our competition. We're going to be super capitalist here and put this on the market. After 7 years. that heyday is over. The patents are expired, and anybody can make this as a generic drug. It's sort of like the situation we're in with antibiotics. When antibiotics were first invented, it was phenomenal. I'm not saying that antineoplastins are like antibiotic, where every single person that comes into contact with it, this medication, it does its job. But
right.
The point is that it becomes a generic drug, and anybody can make it. So then, what happens? I mean, you're no longer in the world of competing with new proprietary therapies with an army of lawyers to defend the patents that, you know, you keep moving. Everything about antineoplastins goes against everything that the business represents. The business represents minor increases in efficacy and safety to make a fortune. But you can take tiny little incremental, like, millimeter steps, because that's just the only way you can survive as an industry. You know, this economy is based upon scarcity and proprietary substances. It's not based upon economical things. For instance, it's just so hilarious that we call it an economy when it's nothing but economic. You know, anyway, I could go on forever about this, but essentially, it would just destroy the entire paradigm, no matter how you looked at it, if this was unleashed. Yeah. So to answer your question, the only way it could ever be approved is through a huge political power struggle. It's nothing to do with science. It's nothing to do with following the rules. They're just placating Brzezinski and placating the public as long as they possibly can, and they have for the last three decades when it comes to this therapy. I mean, they're not...
Okay, so they'll basically dangle the carrot in front of Brzezinski. You know, if you're a good boy and you follow the rules, that you will eventually get, you know, what you wanted, but we're hoping that, you know, you give up before we ever afford to do this. Brzezinski has had some fairly powerful supporters because, I mean, just naturally some of the people whose lives he saved have been the children of people like congressmen or whatever, or some relative of a congressman. So along the way, he's picked up some supporters with influence, and that's probably helped.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, this thing is bigger than probably anything that anyone's ever had to deal with. He's had some huge congressmen support him. I mean, I've even had David Axelrod, President Obama's former chief of staff, watch the film back in 2009 before I even released it and said, "This is just too big," he says. Maybe in 10 years we can face this, but it's just too big. You know, he even alluded that the economy would be destroyed, you know, if you let it out. So that gives you an idea what you're dealing with. He's like everyone, Nancy Pelosi, you name it, everybody knows about Brzezinski. In fact, Nancy Pelosi helped some Brzezinski patients get the therapy back in the 90s. I mean, it's everyone knows about it. But no
what
one
is
the
functional system that we live in where people are more concerned about theoretical impacts on the economy or you know, going up against powerful lobbies than they are about saving lives?
Absolutely. It's a great example of the system that we live in and this where we're at as a society. From where I stand, where I've been spending a lot of time with it, trying to philosophically figure it out and all sorts of ways to try to figure it out. My best guess or best conclusion is it's the system itself. I know it's not easy to change a whole system, but the system itself breeds this behavior and rewards this behavior. Everybody is completely well rewarded, with the exception of being cured from cancer, for being this way and squashing and destroying this, because they have to protect the establishment and they protect the status quo. It's like almost like they have to. It's just sort of understood that this can't allow.
Well, they're behaving very much like a cancer. Like a cancerous tumor is, you know, it's sort of, I shouldn't anthropomorphize, I shouldn't pretend that a cancer thinks, but, you know, basically a successful cancer maintains itself, and despite all of the bad things about cancer cells and about the how destabilized they are and how dysfunctional they are, a cancer can only survive if it can reproduce itself. And the problem with the cancer industry is, of course, if it came across some relatively cheap and non-toxic treatments, then the power of the cancer industry would be utterly destroyed, or almost utterly destroyed.
Absolutely. That's a perfect analogy. In fact, that's a great analogy. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the cancer within our system, and within our system, it's very metaphorical to what the real cancer in our society, you know. Absolutely.
Yes, and I mean, even like what we're really protecting is a relatively small elite in society. I mean, the cancer industry includes oncologists, pharmaceutical companies. There's a very small number of people in society who benefit financially to a tremendous level. I mean, I don't know what the average salary of an oncologist is, but I know it's got to be at least six figures and probably sometimes seven figures. So they're doing really well, but the problem is that there's a larger number of people, which are people who are diagnosed with cancer, who are suffering.
Yeah, and not only that, when it comes to oncologists, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's not really that hard. I mean, forgive me for saying this, but it's not really that challenging of a profession because you're given such strict rules and guidelines, and you're forced to treat every human being that comes into your office like just another number. So it's like, oh, you have breast cancer with metastasis to the liver. Let's see, what does page 368 say? Oh, okay, you're going to get this, this, and that. And that's it. There's no creativity. There's no, you know, it's just you are a robot. You know, you're getting whatever the system tells you to give. There's no, you know, there's no individual, you know, care. So it's really quite sad. And, of course, a lot of the oncologists do get commissions and kickbacks for recommending certain chemotherapies and things like that. You know, it's like anything within this business world. So
and even the clinical trials, like doctors get payments for each patient in a clinical trial, is my understanding.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of things like that. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you've got, I mean, I think the way, this is my theory of personal economics, is that the people who do extremely well economically are the people who discover how to get multiple revenue streams for the same thing. I'm much more familiar with AIDS than cancer, but if there are sort of like non-profits related to AIDS, who will get money from the patient, who will get money from pharmaceutical companies, who will get money from the government, who will get money from foundations. And sort of each institution doesn't really know where all the money is coming from. And so if you take all the streams, which individually might not be enough to sustain you, but if you can get three or four or five streams going, you can do extremely well and look like you're serving the public when in actual fact what you're doing is serving yourself.
Right. Yep.
And so a little bit about your background. Did you know anything about medicine or cancer prior to 2007 when you read the book, The Cancer Industry?
Well, I was essentially no, to answer your question, no, not at all. I essentially just, I've always been a big fan of nonfiction and documentary films that really sort of bucked up against the status quo, if you will. And I've worked on, I don't know, like some Michael Moore films or whatever, you know. And I wasn't really left or right leaning, so I'm not really that much. I don't really see much merit in either. But to answer your question, no. I just read Ralph's book and a big light bulb went off and I just started researching all of it. I didn't just pick Brzezinski. I started researching almost every one of those chapters and finding patients that have been treated by these therapies, or finding the original physicians or whatever. I interviewed everybody from Max Gerson's family to some Burton people, to Gonzalez, to Brzezinski, to, you name it. I just sort of looked at all of it and, just did my own sort of investigative research, if you will, and decided to use, take the Brzezinski therapy. But I feel like, you know, I'm not a doctor, but it's not that hard to read the English language. You know, it's not that hard to just do what's basic investigative journalism and meet patients, see how legitimate they are, you know, when you're new to all of this. I ask for medical records. It's pretty straightforward. You know, it's like we cut their head open and we diagnosed it with this. Okay, there's a diagnosis, and then it was there's a second and third opinion. Okay, this person really had cancer. Okay, and then they go, oh, well, he looked at medical records, and we had no chemo, no radiation. They only chose antineoplastons, and then they're cancer-free a year later. And you see that over and over and over again. It's just pretty, you know, it's, yeah. So go ahead.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you're going to have the material for a lot of documentaries with just Ralph Moss's book, because it's a huge area, and it's one of the other things about any medical treatment that goes against the grain for any reason is that the mainstream media refuses to touch it. I'm sure Brzezinski's had a little bit of attention from the mainstream media because you just can't ignore him. I mean, he's still in Houston, still doing what he's doing. But I'm sure it's vastly less than the attention given to cancer doctors who are vastly less successful in terms of treating their patients.
Absolutely. The press has been unconscionable. They've just been, it's like, I mean, there's like a criminal charges that you can place against the press for neglecting, you know, reality. You know, they'd all have the death penalty. You know, it's like, they've been unconscionable when it comes to Brzezinski. It's amazing. You know, they'll spend 24 hours straight talking about nonsense about a missing Malaysian airline. Mm-hmm. We have a guy curing cancer, and they're like, they just pretend like he doesn't exist. And the only time the press does pay attention to him is when they want to do a negative hit piece on him.
Right.
That will roll around. So, yeah, I mean, that's another problem. I mean, it's just, they used to believe the opposite. Go ahead.
Given that he is quite open about the fact that his therapy does not work with every patient, there must have been some patients who came in with high expectations, who didn't get a response, who are upset about that. And presumably, if you interviewed some of those, you could come up with a negative portrayal.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah. And it's like anything. I mean, when you only have, say, 30% cure rate with one type of cancer, say that I mentioned earlier, that DIPG in kids, that means 70% of these people don't live. So
right.
It's not like it's some magic bullet. It's just, yeah. And it's, again, it doesn't even have... Yeah, I mean, it's not everyone that's going in there is being cured for a million reasons, but, yeah, I mean...
I would think that the thing that you would want to do if you wanted to save lives would be that you would embrace this, and then you'd say, okay, well, why is it only responding in 30% of the cases? Like, are there more proteins that we should be looking for? Are there other alternatives that could be more effective? The last person I interviewed, actually in the last week's show, was somebody who is studying the actual genesis of cancer, who claims that the idea that cancers are caused by mutations is wrong, and that they're actually caused by aneuploidy, which is the wrong number of chromosomes. But the relevance to our topic today is that he says that actually the cancer genome is extremely unstable, and it's not that difficult to kill cancer cells. In fact, cancer cells die all the time because, you know, many of them are non-viable. And so changing the environment in a non-toxic way, you should be able to get cancers to auto-destruct because they're not actually potent things. They're very weak. And once they find an environment in which they can grow, they will grow. But if you dramatically change that environment, and that appears to be the case with things like Coley's toxin, which of course cause severe fevers and things like that, that in many cases result in remissions. Maybe now we should go on and talk about Laetril, which is your third film, which my understanding is a natural substance derived from almonds. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's found in lots of elements of nature, but almonds, or in particularly, in this case, apricot pits. So it's, you know, you eat an apricot, crack it open, inside that little, there's like a little almond-shaped seed inside every apricot or peach. But yeah, this is really fascinating. I mean, again, like I said, this was the story that got me sort of interested in all of this and reading this book, but this film is much different than the Brzezinski films, where I'm not advocating anything. I'm not, in any way, like, when people walk away from watching it and realize that they, oh my gosh, we gotta go to Tijuana to get Laetril. But what's great about the story is it shows how within our system, within this market system, even at the very beginning when the war on cancer was enacted and they're aggressively testing lots of different things, including things that were considered quote unquote quackery, like Laetril, that, that even when you have something that's beneficial, then it doesn't fit within the market model, it has to be destroyed. So like, it's just sort of like where it all began, if you will. Not that there weren't many things before the 1970s, like Coley's toxins, you know, that were systematically destroyed, just because it just didn't fit within the market. But basically, the gist of it is, the war on cancer was enacted in the early 1970s. 100,000 people-ish a year were going to get Laetril for cancer in Tijuana, and they decided that they wanted to test it formally since they just started a war on cancer. A guy named Benno Schmidt, who was a part of President Nixon's cancer panel, also happened to be a major board member at Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. And he basically with his connections, and, you know, said to Sloan Kettering, we'd like you to test Leia's riddle so we can get beyond this, you know. It's just like a big cloud of mystery. And so they did it. They assigned a guy named Kanmatsu Sugiura, an old Japanese scientist who was a original co-founder of chemotherapy, and he pioneered the idea of even using mice, for instance, as a testing model before they tested it in people. He would catch mice in the basement of the hospital itself. He would go to pet stores and find mice with tumors before they started to breed them, you know, for him. So he'd been at the center for 60 years and was one of the most highly respected people in the field and was a pioneer in so many respects. Anyway, so they said, figured, hey, this is a great guy to give these therapy, this experiment to.
Plus, he probably understands how the world works, so they can rely on him to come up with the right answer.
Correct. And he was sort of an impartial scientist. He was a perfect person to do it because he wasn't really aware of what was going on in Mexico. He just, you know, he was just a scientist that tested whatever he was asked to test, you know. So for 5 years straight, it tested through the roof, meaning that it wasn't a magic bullet or anything, but 80% of the time he tested it, 80% of the mice, had no metastasis, no spread of cancer, versus the placebo group. And then he did months long, like over a year and a half, 2 years long preventative studies where they wanted to see if these mice would not develop cancer. These mice were specially bred to develop cancer, obviously. And 80% of the mice never got cancer at all versus the placebo group. So this was quite fascinating and quite shocking for everybody involved, as you can imagine. So especially coming from a guy who is probably one of the most highly respected laboratory scientists in the world at the time in relationship to cancer. So they go down, they had the Sloan Kettering go down to Washington, D.C. in 1974 while this was all happening, and they basically show the results to the heads of the government heads of the industry, American Cancer Society, National Cancer Institute, FDA, and they said, we'd like to go forward with clinical trials. And it reads like, you know, a wonderful, some sort of a responsible sales pitch for Laetril being a fantastic therapy, potentially in people. They weren't allowed to go any farther. It wasn't really said why. By the way, I have all the internal documents in the movie of these meetings, that were all well documented, and we got them through Freedom of Information Act, you know, back then, people involved, that were following this, got it, and Ralph had them. Anyway, so then in 1975, they go down again, bigger meeting. It reads like a who's who in cancer therapy, you know, back then. There was like, you know, just dozens of people from the NCI and the FDA. Anyone in cancer therapy at the time, that you would see on TV even, you know, talking about cancer was at this meeting. So, and then after this meeting, it's when everything changed. It wasn't said why in the minutes. It makes sense they wouldn't record this, but at some point in that meeting, they were asked, the heads of Sloan Kettering were asked to bury these results. So you have 5 years of studies that's going on at Sloan Kettering. It was hard enough to contain them. But meanwhile, Ralph was helping to leak them to the public, but I'll get that in a minute. So it went from, oh boy, this is interesting, to, okay, none of this has happened. So that's when everything started to fall apart. So Ralph was working there as the public relations guy. He was like the assistant director to public affairs, eventually became that. And he was asked to write press releases that he knew were not real. And by the way, he had also become friends with Dr. Kanmatsu Sugiura because shortly after getting hired, knowing that how long he'd been there, they asked Ralph to write like a biographical piece on him. It was during that research process when he was interviewing Sugiura that he found out when he simply asked, what are you working on right now? I know you come in every day. What are you doing? And he said, I'm working on, you know, amygdalin, which of course was the same as Laetril. And that's where he found out about it. And so he was sort of assigned to follow Sugiura and stay on top of it because Sugiura's lab was in upstate New York while they were in New York City. Sloan Kettering being pretty big, they had labs, you know, various places. So he had to go visit a lot. And it also made sense to keep those Laetril studies off-site, you know, at this lab, you know, for obvious reasons as well. So, yeah, that's when everything started falling apart, when Ralph couldn't figure out why everybody was lying about the Laetril result. Like, what's going on? Because he had no idea that the 1974 and the 1975 meeting had happened. It wasn't until after everything fell apart that that people came forward and were telling him more than he realized, you know, going on. So, anyway.
And he describes in his book how, you know, Sugiura wouldn't do anything to speak publicly about this because he just figured my job is in the lab researching things, and what people do with it is up to them. It's not up to me to go to the public and tell them what my research has found.
Correct. He wasn't a political animal at all. And to give you some more background, I mean, he's sort of like a classic old-school Japanese sort of guy, if you will. I mean, he was a former jiu-jitsu professional when he was a, like, really young child into his teenage years. So it's all about this sort of, just following what is reality, you know, and not like he I don't know, because that's how I can describe it. It's just proud, honest Japanese sort of old school personality, you know,
but
if you will.
Very conscious of his place in society. Like, not, my job is not public relations. My job is not informing the public, so I'm not going to do it. As opposed to Ralph Moss, who was doing what was clearly not his job, which was to get honest information to the public, as opposed to the lies that were sometimes put in front of him.
Correct. You know, I even have some great footage. Just look at Europe. In 1977, in June of 1977, is when, you know, 2 years after that second meeting in Washington, D.C., is when they had this big sort of press conference, and basically saying, you know, nothing worked. But while Sneaky Gurr was sitting right there at the table with them, you know. So they had to say, they had to admit that. Anyway, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that you can see Sigiura perform under pressure right there. And he basically said, well, Sigiura, do you agree with what they're saying here, you know? And he said, well, I agree, but I don't agree. It's like, my results don't agree. Science doesn't agree. But I'll agree with them because they're part of my institution. You know? It's like just like that. And they ask him flat out, you know, do you stick by your results? Which is a very famous line in the Ralph book and in this story. It's like where Sigiura just says, yes, I stick. Which is a very dramatic moment in the press conference, and I was able to find that real footage as well for the movie. Yeah.
And what has been the public reception to your films? I mean, I think it must have been very difficult to get them to the public, but what have people said about your movies once they've seen them?
Sure. Brzezinski was, the first one was fairly, it was always good. It's always fantastic. You'll have a handful of people that just can't believe it. You know, it's always an emotional response. It's not based on factual data or scientific data. It's like, I just can't believe that to be true, you know, because that's just, it's their own personal issues that, you know, with what they can accept and not accept within the society in which they live. Also, the reason Brzezinski was so well received is that no one ever heard of him. And there was only like one or two negative articles on the internet. It was like nothing. And even though he had been all over the news for 10 years straight, he was on Oprah Winfrey before he was syndicated. He was on Sally Jesse Raphael. He was on Bill Maher. He was on the news all the time. But somehow, like on the internet, if you searched his name, you couldn't find anything. And then, of course, when it became really popular, the industry hired all their little evil little goons that write blogs and things like that and try to counteract that, you know. So anyway, Second Opinion has just been released. It's very hard to know how it's going to do, but I don't know. I think it's going to do well. I'm going to be opening it up in New York City and Los Angeles. It's going to have Select City theatrical opening soon, even though it's out already technically, which I think is going to be better because the press it will garner from the big city opening, if you will. You know, people that don't live there, well, you know, if they're reading about it, I'd like to be able to have them have the opportunity to watch it so they can do that. But
People watch these films if they're not able to get to a film festival or screening of these films?
Sure. If they wanted to watch the Brzezinski movies, just BrzezinskiMovie.com, spelled B-U-R-Z-Y-N-S-K-I, movie.com. You can watch them on demand. I actually have, it's on Hulu. If you live in the U.S., it's on Hulu for free. You don't have to pay for it. You just have to deal with the ads. And then, of course, I sell DVDs with that as well, both films. It's on iTunes, Amazon. You know, you can, whatever distribution model you can think of, it's there. And as far as Second Opinion, it's a little different. It's on demand as well, but on Vimeo on demand, you can rent or purchase it. When you watch, you can not only get the film, but you have 12 extra chapters of short films and extras that come with it. So it's almost like two full-length films, if you will.
Wow.
You know, wrapped one. So, and again, that's where I have Coley's Toxins. I talk about that in one of the chapters. Then, of course, I have that on Blu-ray and DVD as well. The production value on Second Opinion I'm very proud of. So they had Blu-rays done of those. And Ralph also wrote a new book called Doctored Results that sort of serves as a companion guide to Second Opinion as well. So, but with the internet, you know, you can find it really easily.
Oh, okay. So if people go to Eric Merola, is Merola the right pronunciation of your last name?
Yes, that is correct, yes. If they go to ericmarola.com, it is all centralized, of course. My name is Eric
right.
Marola. It's E-R-I-C-M-E-R-O-L-A.com, yep.
Okay, so they can find out all this information about watching your films from that
Absolutely. Place. Sure.
And do you have plans for working on something in the future, whether it's related to cancer or medicine or other things? Like, do you have other projects on the go, or are you still concentrating on marketing Second Opinion?
I'm definitely concentrating on marketing Second Opinion, but as you can imagine, my wheels are always turning. When I did the first Brzezinski movie, I knew I was going to do a sequel, and I knew I wanted to do Second Opinion. I'm at the point where I don't know exactly what I want to do, but I have like four or five ideas that I'd like to think about doing, if you know what I mean. And some of them are medical related again, some of them are not. Some of them are more getting to the heart of this whole system and the underlying cancer within, as you said earlier. Instead of concentrating on just a certain faction of this broken system, why not analyze the system itself? So I don't know, I'm not really sure yet.
But I think one of the formative things in my life regarding cancer in particular was I was always interested in reading a newspaper, and I was, a kid in the 1960s. And, I would read an article that would say, scientists have discovered so-and-so, positive results in mice. This potentially could, in the future, result in the development of new cancer therapies or even a cure for cancer. And after a while, I started to realize, all these stories are basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
And they all promise that somewhere down the line, years down the line, that there will be some dramatically better cancer therapy. But after a few years, you realize that actually nothing has changed over the 10 years since, maybe I'd started reading these these articles. And I started to wonder, is there ever going to be change, or are we just kind of sticking out a... throwing some crumbs to people every once in a while, but we're never actually going to give them a loaf of bread.
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, you couldn't sum it up better. Think about it. It doesn't make sense to find the cure. I know how crazy this sounds, but if you find the cure, then you put yourself out of business as well. Now, morally, of course, finding a cure is what we all would want. If we're diagnosed with something like this, we want to have a cure. But financially, economically, it doesn't make sense to find one. And if you do have one, it makes sense economically to destroy it. You're talking.
What I've discovered more recently is worse than the issues. Bad as the issues you are covering are, that with things like breast and prostate cancer, we're actually over-diagnosing. So we're telling people who have lumps that will never grow into a cancer that they have cancer, and that they must take toxic drugs for this cancer, and that's the new front in cancer, and that's the main benefit to the system of mammography or PSA testing, is that you bring more people into the system, people who don't need your services. So it's not like somebody's discovered a brain tumor in you. They have discovered an innocuous lump in your breast, and they're now going to do surgery and chemotherapy and radiation and make a bucket of money, and you're going to spend the rest of your life with disfigurement and pain. That is shocking. I mean, the system is getting worse and not better. So, I really hope, as you said earlier, the only real way that change is going to occur is if the average person wakes up out of their sleep, stops, absorbing the crap that comes out of the television and out of the mainstream media, and starts demanding change and knowing what they want for that change.
Yeah, you're right. And also, something else I'll say that about this whole experience for me is that if I had to do it all over again, I think I would have done it differently. I mean, I also think that making Brzezinski so popular was maybe a mistake. What I'm trying to say is I think that these kinds of therapies are never going to survive within the current system. They have, once they're found and once they're discovered, you can't let the current system know they exist. You know, you almost have to create an underground sort of category or allow people that people can find out about it and acquire it in an underground fashion, because the moment the industry knows it's there, they're going to chase it down and destroy it. So, you know what I mean? It's the opposite of everything we've been taught. So I almost feel like, if you have a cure like this, it needs to be well protected and not brought into the mainstream, because the mainstream is just a pack of lines that will just tear it apart. You know?
Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, the problem with bringing antineoplastons or anything into the mainstream is that the mainstream requires patented chemicals, and that seems to imply highly toxic chemicals. So if they did get their hands on antineoplastons, they would have to throw away, somehow get rid of the natural therapies, and they would have to come up with purely artificial drugs, which probably would have more significant side effects because they're not natural substances. We'd have to patent them, and then every time the patents expire, they would have to say, oh, now we have a new improved drug that's now $20,000 a month and has some beneficial effects.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have to come to the end of our show. I can't believe it's been an hour, but it just about has been. So do you have any final remarks that you would like to make?
No. But I would say that anyone that's seen my Brzezinski films, I think you'll really like Second's Opinion. It's a much different film, and it really gets more to the heart of the matter. But, yeah, I mean, no, this has been good. I think it's been a good talk. Thanks for having me on this kind of show.
I'll send you the link later, and for people who listen to this, don't forget to go to ericmarola.com, and of course, don't forget to listen to my previous shows and what's going to be coming up in the next few weeks. Thanks very much for listening, and Eric, thank you for being with me. Goodbye.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.